I want to call the meeting to order. Welcome to the committee members. First, we have our after-school bill, so that will be our first bill of the day. Then we will have House File 106, Representative Swales. We will have a presentation on the effects of early maltreatment and trauma on children and families by Dr. Bruce Perry, and then a short presentation on the February forecast. So we've got a packed agenda, and hope you all will stay throughout. We know it's tough timing with this committee. Representative Blythe?
If I could, just before we get started, I wanted to point out that I have a number of students here from my district, 6th to 12th grade students. They're actually here to support the bill that you're going to talk about, and they've been participating in prime time in Northfield. And they're middle school students, high school students, and students from a group called The Key, which is the longest standing youth-run youth organization in the country.
Oh, interesting. Thank you. Should we clap for them? Are they right
yes,
over here?
Right.
That's awesome. Great. Well, thank you for coming down and watching Democracy in Action and being part of it. And thank you, Representative Blythe, for introducing your group. Members, how about Representative Blythe? Have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
I have. And I'd like to move the minutes.
Thank you. Representative Blythe needs approval of the minutes for March 3rd. Is there any discussion? Okay. Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion passes, and the minutes for March 3rd are approved. Members, we have one motion we need to make before we get started with the bill, and that was on House File 601, which we had... It looked like whether we were going to lay it over for possible inclusion or whether we were going to lay it on the table at the end of our last hearing. So right now the bill is suspended, and we want to move that House File 601 be laid over for possible inclusion. So I'm going to do that. I move that House File 601 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Omnibus Bill. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, just a quick reminder of which bill that was.
This is the one on allowances. It was the day that we had the big snowstorm,
yep.
So that was the first thing. So attendance okay. was funny, and we had some people not make it. It was the three things, allowances, the school readiness connections, and the family, friend, and neighbor, those ones. And so by the end of the time the bill was done, we had just a couple of people in the room. And so that's what we want to make sure. And by laying it over for inclusion, as we do with most bills in this committee, it simply sits sort of in a holding tank. Until we create our omnibus bill. So it doesn't necessarily, as you know, imply that we're going to take or finalize all the pieces of that bill.
Right.
Thank you. Representative Downey?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we need to vote on that then, or is it's just information that it's being laid over?
My understanding is it's information. So thank you, and I think we had talked about it a little bit before that. Okay.
Perfect.
Good. Well, thank you. We have the mayor waiting, and Representative Rosenthal, are you ready to
yes.
come take over and we'll proceed?
Welcome, Representative Falk. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 378 for possible inclusion and the House Omnibus Early Childhood Finance and Policy Bill.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm delighted, members, to bring you this bill here today. We have a great group of testifiers lined up, and I think you will learn a lot from all of them. We met right before this, so it's been interesting hearing about their programs. Members, we know that success at school increases when students feel connected to their school and community, when they have the personal skills and goals to take responsibility for their own learning. Annually, each young person in Minnesota spends about 90 to 1,000 hours in school and has about 2,000 hours of non-school or discretionary time, which is roughly the equivalent of a full-time job. So while they're spending a lot of time in school, they're certainly spending a lot of time out of school as well. We know that learning doesn't end when the bell rings, but it continues with the experiences young people have outside of school. With that, I'm going to have the testifiers talk about their experiences. What happened, members, is last year we had money to allocate.
Representative Solik?
Yes.
Is the bill in the order you'd like it?
I do have an amendment, Mr. Chair. The amendment is the copy of it, I hope. The 0641 amendment? Is that right? No. Okay.
A1. 378A1.
I will need a copy of the amendment. Got it. Okay, thank you. So I'd like to move the 378A1 amendment.
Representative Slavik offers and authored the amendment to House File 378A1. Does everyone have the amendment? Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Motion carries. Proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, members, for helping us get the bill in the shape that we needed to move forward. What this does is instead of Representative Downey that won't have to make a motion, we're reducing it ourselves from $10 million to $5 million. And there is a match associated with this bill, I think. It's still in place. The McKnight Foundation, if we can come up with the $5 million, will match another $1 million. Also, what this amendment does is it leaves the possibility of either taking it out of the general fund or, to the extent possible, the commission would use the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009 funds. In other words, the stimulus funds potentially could be used for this program. So, members, we used to fund after school with state funding from 97 to 2003 when the governor unallotted the funding. And since then, we've been doing one-time funding for these programs. But as you're going to hear from the testifiers today, this is a very important area where we could invest into the base for our area and also, at the same time, invest in kids, affect crime by bringing down crime in the juvenile among juveniles, and do a lot of good for after-school programs. So with that, I'll introduce the next testifier, have him introduce himself, actually, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I want to thank Representative Slawick for her leadership on this issue, as well as all of your leadership on programs for our children. My name is Chris Coleman. I'm the mayor of the city of St. Paul. I know that this committee has spent a lot of time talking about the importance of investing in early childhood, and you know that I'm a strong supporter of early childhood education. It's my pleasure, however, to be before you again today to talk about another very important investment, our youth and the learning that occurs during the 2,000 hours of discretionary non-school hours during after school, summer, and on weekends. In addition to early childhood education, I have made after school community learning a priority in my office and for the city of St. Paul. We call this program, this effort, our Second Shift Initiative. Research has shown that young people use their time when they are not in school directly, how they use their time directly linked with how successful they are as they learn, grow, and develop through adolescence and into adulthood. When young people engage in meaningful after-school and community learning opportunities, they're more connected with their learning, with school, and are more civically connected with their community. These intentional connections can help young people avoid crime, teen pregnancy, and other negative issues they face. They also help build our future workforce and are the lifeline to our economic vitality. And more after-school programs help protect investments in early childhood education, a topic I know you're all very interested in. You've heard me say it before, and I'll say it again. Education and learning, whether it's early childhood education or after-school learning, is my crime-fighting strategy, it's my economic development strategy, it's my community development strategy, and it really determines the quality of life in our communities. In 2007, the Minnesota After School Community Learning Grants funded three programs in the city of St. Paul. The West 7th Community Center, we have Julie Murphy and Jeff Martinka are here with us today. The University of Minnesota and Westside Neighborhood Collaborative, and the Eastside Learning Collaborative through the St. Paul Parks and Recreation Department. In total, close to $1 million were allocated to help children achieve academic success and to help children and youth successfully transition to becoming productive adults through leadership skills, community service, increased knowledge of career, and post-secondary educational opportunities. Beyond working with young people and families, these three programs have demonstrated partnership and collaboration, building community systems and innovation. For example, the Eastside Learning Collaborative has been able to collectively design KidVenture No School Day and Summer Camp, leverage financial resources from local funders, establish a youth-centered neighborhood-based transportation system that supports young people's access to learning opportunities. It's published a neighborhood-based program guide, which you all have a copy before you. It's done professional development for people who work with youth, and it's collected data across organizations. The West 7th community is pooling services and providing a one-stop shop with comprehensive services for school-age and middle school students. Many business leaders are calling for skills such as decision-making, leadership, problem-solving, and teamwork. After-school learning opportunities provide space to learn and practice these skills. Many of us, elected officials and community leaders, are looking for active, engaged voters who are employed, economically self-sufficient, and stable in family and community life. After-school learning opportunities provide space to learn and practice these skills. The percentage of children graduating from high school rises from 65% to 91% when investments in children's non-school hours continue through childhood and adolescence. In the words of our president, in a global economy where the most valuable skill you can sell is your knowledge, a good education is no longer just a pathway to opportunity, it is a prerequisite. I urge you to support young people, our communities, and our future by supporting this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mayor Coleman.
Thank you. We appreciate you being here on the leadership. Good. Next, we have the Northfield Convention, and we're going to start with Marty Thompson, if you want to.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee and our very own representative, David Bai. My name is Marnie Thompson, and I serve as an assistant principal at Northfield High School, and I'm also the school district's school connectedness and truancy prevention coordinator. I'm here today to talk about the importance of our out-of-school time program, Prime Time, which stands for Promoting Responsible Individuals Through Mentoring and Enrichment. This is a highly collaborative effort to assure out-of-school time programming for Northfield youth in grades 4 through 12. Our prime time program consists of four main programs, PLUS, which is an after-school enrichment program that meets 4 days a week at our elementary school, the Middle School Youth Center, an after-school center that is open daily at our middle school, the KEY, a year-round youth-run teen center in downtown Northfield, which you will hear more about in just a few minutes from Ruth, and Summer Plus, a free 9-week academic and recreational program for elementary and middle school students. Last year, during our first year of funding with the Minnesota After School Community Learning Grant, 1,170 Northfield youth participated in one or more of the prime time programs. That is approximately one-third of our entire student body, K through 12. Each site offers homework help, skill-building workshops on topics selected by the kids, one-on-one mentoring, cultural and gender-specific groups, college and career exploration, youth leadership opportunities, family events, and service learning experiences. As a high school assistant principal and the truancy prevention coordinator, these programs are a dream come true because they are gang prevention, drug and alcohol prevention, bullying prevention, and truancy prevention programs at their very best. We know that when kids experience positive relationships with adults, meaningful roles, high academic expectations with support for learning, we're going to see decreases in incidents of fighting and bullying, decreases in absenteeism, and increases in their academic performance and graduation rates. Students experience all three of those components in our after-school programs, and already we are seeing the positive effects of those programs in the short time we have had our Minnesota After-School Community Learning Grant. Just as research has shown, the economic benefits of investing in early childhood programs, the same is true for our after-school programs. By putting the funding up front in prevention measures, we are saving millions of dollars down the road due to the consequences of kids dropping out of or becoming disengaged from school. When kids are with us for 2 to 3 hours after school, participating with each other, teachers, community members, in meaningful activities in a safe and caring space, we are increasing their feelings of connectedness to our school and community. Research shows that this connection is an incredibly powerful bond, second only to parents in terms of power. In fact, it can change a child's life course. A good example, 2 years ago, I worked with a middle schooler who refused to come to school. School for her was hard and not terribly interesting. She was quickly disengaging and at risk for dropping out. As part of our school connectedness program, I went to pick her up at home many, many times. I dragged her to school. I set her up with one of our Promise Fellows, got her a mentor, got her involved in the Middle School Youth Center. She was encouraged to get involved in leadership opportunities. And lo and behold, her attendance improved, her grades went up. And now as a high school, she is serving as a volunteer in the very same program that supported her during her rocky middle school years. There's story after story that I could share with you that illustrate the importance of these programs in making connections with kids. It's about creating a solid infrastructure of protective factors outside of the school day. With increasing class sizes and stress to families, I firmly believe that one of the most valuable things that these programs do is to help youth connect to school and to their community. It's so much easier and cheaper to lay this foundation than try to change behaviors once they've started. 96% of the kids in our program reported that staff care about them, and that is one of the very most important protective factors for kids. We are also seeing significant academic improvement among our students as a result of participating in these programs. Last school year alone, 83% of our kids, keep in mind we had 1,170, showed improved academic scores, 83% after 1 year of involvement. The average primetime student improved over 3 percentile points in math and language usage on nationally standardized tests. This means if the student began the year in the 50th percentile nationally, he or she ended up at the 53rd, which was a growth rate roughly twice their peers that were not in the program. Primetime also supports community engagement and college and career ambitions. 73% of the kids stated that they had much better awareness of community resources, and 80% reported that they had discussed with program partners their college and career plans and their aspirations for the future. Our results have far exceeded our expectations. Our after-school programs are proving to be great equalizers. Kids with very few opportunities are able to access safe, stable, enriching programs that improve their academic performance and hopes for the future. We know these are indeed tough economic times with difficult funding choices to be made. We do leverage local and other grant dollars to help fund these programs, but we rely on multiple funding sources. These programs also employ many local people in addition to the many volunteers that serve in the programs. With more families working harder than ever to make ends meet and survive, we need to be sure that kids have access to safe, free, enriching activities when they might otherwise be unsupervised during prime times for trouble. One of our greatest advocates is the manager of our local trailer court. She has noted, and the Northfield Police Department has confirmed, that when kids are involved in after-school and summer programs, the vandalism and other crimes decrease in their neighborhoods. In addition to providing supervision, these programs provide valuable academic, social, and marketable skills that will help them succeed in an increasingly competitive economy. Please work really hard to ensure that funding for these valuable programs continues in the future, and we promise we will work really hard to ensure that every dollar is well spent. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson.
Thank you. Must be one of the favorite teachers, assistant principal. Next, we have two students, Champagne, who's a middle school student. Champagne, do you want to move over one? And we'll have you. And she even brought her grades and wondered if you guys might want to see them, members. So said maybe they will. And then we're going to hear from Ruth, who is a high school student from the city of North Carolina.
Champagne. Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Champagne Eisenberg. Mr. Chair and the members of the committee, I am... the reason I'm here today is to tell you about my experiences with after-school programming and how it has affected me throughout my life. First of all, I try to encourage as many people as I can to go. I've talked to my family, my friends, and people that would like to join, and I encourage them a lot because it's important. And I moved here from Farmington a year ago, and from that, my grades have increased. My friendships with my friends have gone steady, and I trust the people I'm around, and I don't feel threatened by the people I'm around. When I first moved here, my back shed was spray painted, and my mom didn't think maybe this would be such a great place to live, but I went to school, and the school was great. The teachers encouraged you to do your homework, come to school, talk with the teachers if you needed help. So I talked to the teachers, and my science and math scores were not doing so great. So I went to after school programs, and I got put with a mentor, and they talked with me. They showed me how to do math problems easier so that I wouldn't have to concentrate so hard, because that they thought that would maybe be the problem, is I'm trying so hard to figure out the problem that it's just going right past me how to do it. My experiences with my grades, they have extremely gone up. My math was, when I first came, was a D, and now it's almost an A. My science score was a D, and it's a C now. But our teacher is very strong on us, so it's really hard to keep your grade up. But I'm getting on it. I want to be a lawyer when I'm older, and every step I take is a better step of getting to become a lawyer, because I'm learning from math skills, science skills, from geography skills, and the importance of friendship, and the teachers there, that they truly do want you to succeed in school, go to college, and become whatever you want. I personally know from experience that when you do go to after school programs, there's less violence. There's less, and during school, there's less violence. Recently, we have had less people going down to the office, less people going to a nurse from getting hurt, punched, or beat up, less bullying, which I have experienced bullying for over 4 years, and now I go to school and I have a smile on my face, ready to go to school. I'm not scared to. And as soon as you walk in the door, they're like, oh, hi, how are you? How was your day? And I'm like, oh, it was good. So it's been a very good experience. As to my other friends, they go to the youth center, and their grades have gone up. I'm not sure how much, but I hope that what I've said today has encouraged you guys to earn money for us. I accept your willingness to give me time and the opportunity to come here and speak with you guys. And I thank the committee, and if anybody would like to see my grades.
Thank you, and keep up the great work.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Champagne, I just want I want to tell you, we don't need to see your grades, because Representative Mara, you can check them, but Champagne, we as legislators have a lot of people testify at committees all the time, and as you were sitting there testifying, the confidence just eroded from you. It just came out and blossomed. I mean, we could see the confidence, and we could see the sincerity and the growth that you've shown. So congratulations to you, and lawyers, watch out as you go to that law school.
Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Ruth Ammerman. The chair, kitty. First, you'll have to excuse me. I'm getting over a bad cold, so if I burst out and sneezes or coughing, I apologize ahead of time. Like I said, my name is Ruth Ammerman. I'm here as part of a collaborative after-school program that is funded by the Minnesota Department of Education After-School Community Learning Program. Part of the collaborative is also funded by the Office of Justice Youth Intervention Program. I've had the honor and the privilege to be part of the Northfield Union of Youth, also known as the KEY, for 3 years now. The KEY is a youth organization that has celebrated its 15th anniversary this year. Unlike most youth organizations, the KEY is completely youth-run. We have a 15-member board that votes and decides everything the KEY does, from everyday running and rules to what kind of concerts and programs we host. The board meets every Wednesday, and the meetings are open to everyone, and all youth in the community are encouraged to come and participate. The mission statement of the KEY is to give a voice to and empower youth in the community. And since our beginning 15 years ago, we have more than accomplished that. The KEY represents a safe environment where kids can come, participate in the community, and find a home with their peers during peak at-risk hours. They are taught that their voices can be heard, and even as youth, they can be leaders and role models to all ages. I personally have benefited enormously by becoming involved in the KEY. 4 years ago, my family faced a huge tragedy when my father died. And I found my home base shattered. Around that time, I started coming down to the KEY and just hanging out. What I found was the security and sense of belonging that I had lost. And I am only one of hundreds of kids that have been influenced for the better by the KEY. I know that all of you are working hard and are probably very busy, but if you ever find the time, I invite you down to the KEY, 303 Water Street, Northfield. Because having even one KEY kid will prove to you the importance and influence the KEY organizations like it have on the lives of Minnesota's youth. And that for the sake of our future, these are not the only organizations we can afford to lose.
Well done. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I, for one, do want to come down and see the KEY.
Then follow.
Thank you. We very much appreciate it. It's very good to, the emotion is real, and the programs that these students are involved in are life-changing, as we can see. So, next we have, close to where I live, from Landfall, the community organizer, Tom, who's going to introduce himself and talk about his program.
The chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Yesta. I'm a community organizer that works for Family Means. It's a nonprofit agency based in Washington County. I direct two youth development programs, both that are sited in mobile home communities. One of which, the City of Landfall, was one of the recipients of the after-school community learning grant this past round. The program is in its 16th year of operation in Landfall, and this is my 16th year of work in Landfall. There's a handout that talks in detail about some of our work and accomplishments in Landfall, but I'd like to take this opportunity to talk about the value and impact of this grant and youth development in general. In Landfall, I believe that youth development truly is community development. Directing resources towards youth positively affects the whole community. Landfall is a small community. It's a population of 700. Both the citizens and the municipality itself have limited resources. Based on census data, Landfall is one of the 10 poorest cities in the state. Nearly half the families with school-aged children live in poverty. 85% of K-12 students are eligible for free and reduced lunch. And only two businesses reside in the city. There's not much of a tax base there. Funding through this grant enables Family Means to provide an infrastructure for youth development. The city has no typical youth-serving institutions like schools or churches within its border. Family Means, our program, is in the community full-time throughout the year, offering free programming that all youth can walk to. We serve K-12 youth, and we offer three programs. K-5 program that we call the Investigation Station, a teen center, and then a summer bike repair and ride program. Because we're studying the community, we also connect with parents, and we help that meets their family's needs. We work with them obtaining clothing and supplies for their children, activity scholarships, connecting them with affordable health care and energy assistance. In our work, we also build partnerships with schools and institutions and businesses and government to bring in the resources that are unavailable in the city or we're unable to provide ourselves. We have a strong relationship with the local school to social service needs, academic support resources. We partnered with an area church who now offers free tutoring, one-on-one tutoring, two nights a week during the school year. And we've done things for the both kids and families and the residents as well, and working with the county to offer free flu shot clinics to keep residents healthy. In 2008, our program served 200 youth. Family Means provides a wide variety of activities for kids, including the arts, nutrition education, things like woodworking, Girl Scouts, and fitness activities. The After School Community Learning Grant assisted us in promoting the capacity of youth to become productive adults. Two broad categories of activities were supported specifically by this grant. One was just getting kids exposed to and learning technology, internet research, and word processing skills. We exposed them to the creative side of using computers and technology. They got to compose music on the computer. They got to do simple animations. And these are kids in kindergarten to fifth grade. In our bike program, where we teach kids bike repair, we use graphing software so kids can see how strong and how consistently the spokes in the wheel are. So it's an application they could potentially use as an engineer down the road. Things like the internet research skills are what some business community members call the new basic skills, and what people need to succeed in the business world. And we also get the opportunity to talk about things like internet safety, so kids know there are some dangers in using the internet. The other broad category of work that we do based on this grant was just improving kids' broader connections to the community. I mean, Landfall is a pretty insular community. One, it's insulated geographically and insulated economically. It's one of the poorest communities in the state, in one of the most wealthiest communities and wealthiest counties in the state. So we make sure that kids that don't have and families that don't have means have the opportunity to know what possibilities are out there and to discover their skills and their interests. So we offer a spectrum of arts activities. Our teen center director engages kids in planning multiple community events so they're engaged and involved in the community. We work with middle and high school kids to start thinking about what their skills are, what their interests are, and connect them to possible careers and life after high school. We also offer things like fitness activities, like free karate and swim lessons and soccer teams. I mean, these things not only contribute to youth's physical well-being, but they are a means for youth to feel accomplished and competent. It costs Family Means approximately $1,500 a year to provide year-round programming for one youth. And comparably, it would cost parents about $3,000 to receive a similar amount of care provided by the school district. And given the available census data, that's about 10% of the Landfall's median household income. Our work we believe, has impacted both youth, their families, and the entire community. 96% of Landfall's third to fifth graders made adequate yearly progress on the state tests during the 2006-2007 school year. Within our program, 90% of our K-5 youth said they've learned things in our program that helped them in school. 89% of the teen center youth said they've learned how to work with other kids, other teens, to get things done. And 79% of our K-5 kids said our programs offer them things they can't get anywhere else. When we surveyed parents, they said they believe their children's program participation improves their academic performance and also their social skills. In 1992, before we began our programming in Landfall, we did a community needs assessment and asked residents in a survey to describe what some of the needs and what the serious concerns were in the community. At that point, 69% of the residents that returned surveys said the lack of youth programming was a serious problem. In the resident survey we did last year in 2008, that percentage dropped to 6%. Between 2000 and 2008, juvenile offenses decreased to 89%. Our teen program was launched in 1999.
I'm going to ask you to try and wrap it up a little.
Okay.
A little bit. Thank you.
Funding is always a struggle for nonprofit after-school programs, even before the financial crisis. Family Means has to work to get nearly 20 sources each year to keep our programs in operation. Few funders do multi-year funding. Many just do it in small amounts. So the After School Learning Communities Grant has afforded our community an opportunity to provide these meaningful experiences that impact both the community and both the residents. I just want to end in closing with one story about the impact of youth development and landfall. In 1999, when we were considering or starting on a road to develop a teen center, we conducted some focus groups. And we asked our teen center, the potential teens, you know, what they thought about landfall. They told us they didn't tell kids they lived in landfall because it was a trailer park. Last year, a Star Tribune reporter came to landfall because we received a national award, and they were talking to kids. And what did the teen say to the reporter this time about living in landfall? He said, yeah, people always come here from other places. It's because they don't have the same stuff going on. They're jealous. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I believe we have one other testifier, Dr. Ephraim here.
Mr. Chair, if I just had one question to testify, some of us are wondering where landfall is. I've lived in Minnesota all my life. I missed that one.
Landfall is in Washington County. It's on the Ramsey-Washington County border, about 6 miles east of here, where 3M, it's just east of the 3M complex.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Very close to where I live. There's a Harley Davidson motorcycle place on 94. Have you ever seen that? Oh. That's right.
That helps us.
Welcome. Could you state your name for the committee, please, for the record?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I'm here on behalf of Ed Watts. And unfortunately, I think my comments are probably going to be as welcome as a skunk at a garden party in this particular committee. But as a parent, a pediatrician, and a taxpayer representing a grassroots organization, we think it's important to point out that while all these programs sound wonderful and I'm sure are doing wonderful things, we are facing a financial crisis. And real businesses, real families who provide all of the tax dollars that fund these programs are having to make serious cuts on every front, losing jobs, having to move, having to cut back on everything. And I would point out that that Minnesota is on par to lose a congressional district because of exodus from the state, likely due to high taxes as well as our wonderful weather. So we do need to pay attention to what we're doing on economic development and taxes. And the other thing I would really point out is that while these programs have been stated to have good effects, statistically it's small. And the greatest effect on student achievement is living in an intact family. And one of the sheets that I passed out was a list of studies. And number three on that list is by Dr. William James, the effect of Black and Hispanic 12th graders living in intact families and being religious on their academic achievement. Using a large study of 20,000 youth, these intact families and religious involvement not only decreased the achievement gap, it erased it. We need to be funding programs that work. We need to be not taxing intact family. We need not to be taxing every family to the point that parents have to join the workforce instead of raising their children. And we have to be thinking about welfare reform and divorce reform before we are funding nice but unaffordable luxury type of programs when we have great needs in K through 12 during the school day. So I'd be happy to answer questions about specific studies, but
thank you.
That's the issue. And then the other thing, the other handout that I passed out were a list of programs in education and health and human services that we feel should be examined for reduction or elimination.
Thank you. Representative Diskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question to this testifier, so if we're ready to ask questions on the bill.
I think we are ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Swawick, thank you for the updated tracking sheet. I do appreciate that. I saw it was printed today, as a matter of fact, at 3:30. In looking at line 20, I see that the February forecast did not factor in any after-school learning grants into the February forecast, and I do believe that's appropriate, as at the end of this biennium the funding runs out. It wasn't to be continued. But if that's correct, Representative Swalwick, is it your understanding then that the forecasted deficit would be another $5 million more if this were to go into effect?
Mr. Chair, Representative Diskin, I think we've had this conversation before with the last bills, and part of this is when we have good programs that were one-time funded, which is what this program is that it's important to bring it forward and to talk to the members about some of the work that is going on out there. But as I mentioned last time, we took it from a $10 million request to a $5 million request with a McKnight match. But no, I mean, in the end, we will have a target to deal with. And the target, as I've mentioned before, will likely be either flat or a cut target. And so this isn't going to make the budget deficit go up by having a proposal. It will be the omnibus bills when we have them. We will have, I'm pretty confident, cut targets.
Okay. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess this question is directed at Dr. Ephraim, and your comments are interesting. And you know, we would probably agree that an intact home with parents at home is great, and probably is the best situation for children, although I think that interaction with their peers and the ability to work together in teams and after-school programs is also very advantageous. But the reality is that many, you know, in our society, and even more so now, I think, because of the economy, we have many children who are home alone and depend on these particular programs after school because their parents are working, and that is the reality. And as we start to look at the cuts, and we're developing, I think, each of us as legislators, our own principles around which to make decisions about where to cut, we've developed probably our own list of principles. And one of mine is to look at those things that are prevention programs, things that will save us money in the long run, either from in health and human services, it might be incarceration, it might be in health care, it might be those things that take care of diseases early on. And in child care, it might be those things that keep kids off the street, keep them occupied, and help them to be more successful in school. And I'm just wondering if you would consider the programs that you've heard about today as prevention programs.
Dr. Alfred.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson. I think they are potentially prevention programs, but as with every other type of program and every other type of budget, one needs to prioritize. And the greatest prevention program, the greatest social program, the greatest
and most basic unit of government is the family. And what we need to do is prioritize programs that that maintain intact families and that don't raise taxes to force mothers that who would otherwise want to stay home with their children into the workforce to pay for pay taxes for programs that don't work as well. Or that increase government control or undermine parental authority or indoctrinate students and cause other problems in the long run. Welfare reform. We need to promote paternal involvement. Divorce reform. We need to get rid of no-fault divorce.
Dr. Esselm, I think we're
going
to have to wrap this up. Members, we're going to get to your questions, but we're running out of time.
Thanks for answering my question.
Representative Morion, this bill is going to be laid over. So
okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll just be real brief. I want to thank Representative Flowers for bringing this bill forward. This is actually, these programs are actually, at least as I know, I mean, I've been here for a few years, second generation, maybe even third generation, but certainly at least second generation of efforts that they back to work that this legislature did in a quite frankly, a bipartisan manner during the Carlson years, where we made big investments, at least as much as this. I don't remember the numbers, but at least as much as this into these type of programs. Now, they were structured differently. It was a statewide collaborative. I can't remember the name. It seems to me that, and we did that, members, without the match. We did it straight up with government funds. I suspect programs were out seeking matches anyway. But I'm struck that, you know, having created that kind of effort where we recognize, in fact, that it doesn't need to be families versus programs, it really needs to be both. That's how I conduct my life, with, you know, we provide strong family, unit for our children, but we also avail ourselves of strong community programs that are paid for by myself as a public taxpayer to help me provide a well-rounded, strong effort of guiding my young children to become good adults. We did that 10, 15 years ago. We lost that, quite frankly, in the 2003 massive budget cuts when we decided to deal with our state budget issues only by cutting. And in the meantime, you know, we still have young people. We still have young people who have needs. We still have young people who deserve an opportunity to have a structured, both within their family and within their community, to develop themselves. And so, members, it seems to me that even if you just consider inflation, we're still not even where we were in 1996, 95, when we passed those programs in a bipartisan manner. And so I know we're going to have very tough issues, Representative Swalwick, with any of our proposals that have to do with anything that even just meets the base as well as above the base. But, you know, it's our job to struggle with that issue because the people's work continues, the needs continue. And, you know, maybe very quickly a question for you, Representative Slavik. I don't know this, but is there any possibility of any stimulus monies that, you know, in terms of one shot? I know that in the education stream, the Secretary of Education has been sending strong messages that while, you know, the federal government is looking to assist states, the federal government is also looking for states to try to take advantage, to sort of get a two-for-one here, to try to take advantage of being able to close achievement gaps that are both, you know, racial but also income in nature. And it seems to me that these kind of efforts ought to, at least at first blush, match up with those kind of desires. Any possibility, creative possibilities here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, we passed an amendment that does allow the funding potentially for this to come from the stimulus monies. There's the 18% of the funds are for state fiscal stabilization funds, and those are funds, so potentially we could use the money out of that. But as you know, it's a little unclear how the federal stimulus funds are going to be allocated, but we are definitely keeping an eye open for this, and that would be, you know, frankly, the best possible scenario is that we could use some of those funds.
Thank you.
Representative Jackson.
Thank you. This is a little bit of a follow-up to Representative Peterson and for you, Representative Slawick. I'm a former juvenile defender, and while I don't have any numbers for you, the juvenile justice system is extremely expensive. And what I do know from my time as a public defender is that the vast majority of juvenile crime occurs between 3 and 6 p.m. on weekdays.
Exactly. Point made. And so if you have programs for kids to be in, then they're busy hopefully doing good things. All the students here and the students that participate in the programs, I have kids middle school and high school age, and it's much better if they're busy after school in terms of crime and also teenage pregnancy and all the things that happen. So point well made. Mr. Chair, I think that will make some closing comments. I want to thank the testifiers for being here today. Are there more questions?
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. I'll be very brief. I struggle on this. I have had some experiences myself in large urban settings where too often well-intended programs actually seem to create an economic demand for the very thing we're trying to help lift people out of. And so I have some sympathy for much of what Dr. Ephraim was testifying to. So I'll leave that as just something that I always want to be careful of as we evaluate these programs. And I think I got a bill out there that I will make mention of that would require us for new expenditures to actually substantiate the benefit. It is very easy to pay for good intentions, and it's another thing to actually have the program deliver them. And I think in a time like this where we've actually got to prioritize, it would help us a lot from a public policy standpoint to have some ability to measure the outcomes. And I know it's difficult to do in programs like this, but I think it's too easy to toss out the potential subjective benefits and not hold ourselves accountable as public policymakers to actually follow through with the programs and see what they deliver as compared to feeling good about what we did in one legislative session and then chide ourselves when we don't continue to fund those very same programs, which we've got no concrete evidence that they actually produce the results. So I will continue to try and push us as a committee and as a legislative body to really look at trying to defend our proposals with real outcomes and real benefits as compared to comments and subjective evidence. Thank you.
Do you have any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, maybe I was mistaken, but I thought I did hear real evidence of real results and real things that were happening in the school in Northfield and the schools in Northfield in particular. So maybe I was mistaken, but I'm sure that I did hear that and hear statistics about that. I agree with you, Representative Downey. We should be going more on statistical-based evidence, and I think some of that is there for these programs. Members, you know, we're short on time, so I'm not going to go on, but it would be a great world if there were, you know, two-parent families and mom always stayed home and everybody had all the money they needed and everybody could do everything they wanted, but it isn't that way here, and we are the legislature, and it's our responsibility to legislate for our community and for our state. And in our state, we have a need for after-school programs. We see the good that they do. We see the students are participating. We see how it's changed their lives, and I think that they're here is the evidence, and we have heard it today, and members, I hope we will find the money to continue these programs.
Thank you, Representative Slawick. Thank you, all the testifiers, particularly the school children. I move that House File 378 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Omnibus Bill, as amended.
I'm going to go to the next one.
Thank you to the students. We're going to have to move forward. Members, we're going to have to, because that bill took longer than we thought, we are going to ask Representative Swales to come back, and we're going to have that P20 on another day. So for those of you who are going to testify on that bill, we'll also have to ask you to come back. Next, we're going to have a presentation by Dr. Bruce Perry, if he wants to come forward. Dr. Perry has been in town for a couple days talking about the effects of early maltreatment and trauma on children and families. And he had there was a dinner last night. We know a couple things. One, we know he's on Oprah this week. Is that right?
Yeah.
But I'm very taken. And I asked him how it was last night. How was he on Oprah? And what did you say?
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. I thought it was pretty cool. Yeah. So we're glad you're here. I know you have been doing a whirlwind tour here in Minnesota. And we at the legislature, I think, are hungry for your words. And we appreciate you taking the time to be with us.
It is my great honor. Thank you very much for the opportunity to appear before you. I obviously am more of a resource witness rather than someone testifying about one bill or another. And what I would like to do is figure out a way to be of most use to you in this very challenging process of trying to figure out what to do with limited resources. And in some ways, what I have to say, I don't think is going to be anything you don't already know in one fashion or another. I think everybody who has raised a child or been around children understands that young children are incredibly malleable, that they absorb all kinds of things around them very quickly and much more efficiently than we do, and that their early experiences really shape in many ways who they become. And I think we all kind of know that, one way or another. The thing that has been emerging in research over the last 20 years in child development and brain development is a little bit more detail about the specifics of this malleability, of this great plasticity. And there are some things that I have to say, even being a neuroscientist, I find pretty astounding. Everybody in this room, in order for us to think, in order for us to move, in order for us to have a good feeling, fall in love, have a good idea for a bill, all of this stuff is brain mediated. And the brain, that we carry around in our skull that allows us to be who we are is comprised of billions and billions and billions of nerve cells, which you, I'm sure, all know. But many people don't realize that 99% of the nerve cells in your brain that you use today for all your thinking were present in your brain the day you were born. Which means that's a pretty remarkable phenomenon. Many of you know what synapses are, that basically the way neurons connect with each other and essentially create a functional network. So when I move my fingers, it's because there's a chain of neurons connected by synapses that go from one part of my head through other parts of my brain and out to my muscles and let me move my fingers. And that all of these synapses are essentially the working unit of brain function. And that, and again, in early childhood, it is when the great majority of these synaptic connections are created and the great majority of the neural architecture that you use today is created. So if you look at the fundamental architecture of the brain involved in cognition, it's put in place by the time somebody's 3 or 4 years old. The fundamental neural architecture involved in forming and maintaining healthy relationships is put in place by the time you're 2 years old. The fundamental architecture for motor movement is put in place in the first couple of years of life. The fundamental architecture for being a compassionate, humane citizen is literally laid down in the first year of life. Now, there's all kinds of things that happen as you grow up that elaborate and expand some of these capabilities. But the fundamental architecture of how we're put together is really a product of our early developmental experiences. And if you think through
a few things, it kind of becomes obvious. Many of you, for example, know about children who may have been in some kind of institutional setting and grew up in an orphanage in China or Eastern Europe for a couple of years, and then they're adopted by a loving, consistent, predictable family. But the numbers of these children who, despite that, end up struggling is very high. And it's not because these caring, loving, attentive parents are inadequate. It's because early in their lives, when their brain was developing, there was insufficient stimulation, insufficient nurturing, insufficient, if you will, experience that would allow the brain to organize normally. So we know that early childhood is this very powerful time in life. It's an incredible window of opportunity where if you take a child who is exposed to all kinds of traumatic stuff, and you look at, you know, we have all these children that we work with in the child protective system, for example. The group of children that we have who were raised in relatively nurturing environments in the first year of life, and then for some reason the mother ended up in a bad relationship, there was some traumatic activity, something happened, and they ended up getting into these chaotic, traumatic messes. Those children actually do relatively well in comparison to the children who have 1 year of mess. You know, they'll have 1 year where there's all kinds of chaos and neglect, and then they get into healthy environments. Those kids have worse outcomes. And this again, it's an illustration of the importance of early childhood, the power of early childhood. And yesterday I spoke to the Health and Human Services Committee, I think that's the name of it, about the relationship between these early developmental experiences and physical health. You know, one of the things that we know is that as an adult, your physical health is literally related to the number of adverse childhood experiences that you had. So that your brain not only controls the way you think, the way you feel, the way you believe, but it also controls your immune system. And it controls your endocrine system, your hormones. And it controls what we call the autonomic nervous system that goes out and controls heart, lung, gut, and so forth. So in early developmental trauma increases your risk for diabetes by fivefold, increases your risk for asthma by fourfold, increases your risk for cardiac disease as an adult by 12-fold. So if you look at the morbidity, sort of the burden on our society from early developmental insults, it is astounding. And it crosses the board. It's in health, and health. It's in social functioning. You have these adverse childhood experiences, you have a much higher probability of entering the criminal justice system. You have a higher probability of getting divorced. You have a higher probability of substance abuse. You have a higher probability of, you know, mental health problems. And again, the morbidity on our culture is astounding. You could make a very conservative estimate that 20% of the mental health population in a public health clinic is there because they've had developmental trauma. And that's conservative. And I could go on and on and on with statistics and all that kinds of stuff, but I think what this kind of says from a policy perspective is that if there were programs, if there were ways to ensure or increase the probability of consistency, predictability, nurturing in the first few years of life, you would literally decrease the long-term burden on society in many, many ways. That would, I think, make a lot of sense if you took a long-term view of how to invest your money. I mean, if you're looking for short-term gains, they're present. I mean, if you have high-quality early childhood programs, there are short-term gains. But the real gains are the long-term gains and the next generational gains. And that's something that I think is, you know, I mean, I don't want to tell you what your job is, but the difference between changing a practice and changing a program and changing a law is very significant. Law is more enduring. Law is more focused on the long term. Law should have a longer term vision. And I think that that's, you know, that's one of the opportunities you have in the position you're in. And again, the challenges that were brought up about the fact that you're in a resource-depleted setting makes that even more difficult. But, you know, from a very, you know, the very crude perspective, the biggest bang for your buck is investing in early childhood. And, you can talk about the morality, you can talk about, argue here and there about this study or that study, but there's no doubt that the biggest bang for your buck economically in outcome and productivity for our culture is in early childhood. And this is not just my opinion. This is almost a direct quote from James Heckman, who got the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2000. After part of what he did was an analysis of the economic return on investment for educational activities. And the younger you are when you intervene, the more long-term effect you get. So I'll stop with that, and I would be happy to, you know, because of the work I do in the group I'm with, we've had the opportunity and the honor actually to work in multiple settings in both in the U.S., Canada, and around the world, and they're trying to solve the same problems you are about how do you take a system that didn't previously understand the importance of early childhood and doesn't know where to put. Do we put this in health and human service? Is this something that, what silo do we put this money in? Who has control of early childhood? Is it an educational thing? Is it a health thing? Does this go to juvenile justice? And I think one of the biggest challenges you have is figuring out how to deal with this. Because up until the last 10 years, really maybe even 8-9 years, we haven't thought of this as a legitimate target for a lot of governmental funding. So, anyway, I would be happy to talk with you about how the places have struggled with that and programs that they've tried and thought, you know, had some success and programs that have failed and things that you may have questions about. So,
we do have some questions. Representative Ward?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Perry, that's very interesting. And you began by saying, how could you help us in our jobs here? Well, if you have a contact with Oprah, well, that could really help us. Dr. Perry, I just recently attended a conference, and I can't remember the lady's name, Representative Slawick. It was a lady that was a national speaker at the early education conference I was at, and I can't remember. She was from New York.
Here? No. Really? Oh, Louise Stoney? No.
No, I don't. You might know who I'm speaking about when I ask you this question. She spoke a lot about mirror neurons. I can't say it.
That's all right.
and it's relatively new. It's a relatively new phenomenon, as I understand it. But it's amazing. And she showed that, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
She showed us some video of day old infants.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
what they were, their mirror neurons were doing with the grandfather, the father, the mother.
Yeah.
Can you just share some of that information as well? It was amazing.
It is amazing. I mean, it's one of the, and the thing is, it's something, again, that all of us have kind of seen in one way or another in the way we interact with others. But there's a part of your brain involved in forming and maintaining relationships. Human beings are very social creatures. So, you know, politicians are even more social creatures. And you have very well-developed capacity to be what we call attuned to other people. So you read other people, and you are able to see what is projected to you. And one of the phenomena that happens when you interact with somebody is if they project kindness, you feel kind of safe, and you project back to them the same thing that you're perceiving. Now, this capability is part of that social language gift that human beings have. It's part of what allows us to form and maintain relationships. But it's present at birth. You know, a baby, literally, if you go up to a baby and you go and stick your tongue out like that, they will stick their tongue out. And if you smile at them, and they'll make this little sort of, you know, try to smile, even if they're a baby, but you see it starting to happen. And it's one of the great qualities of early childhood is this ability to absorb what the mother is projecting, what the grandfather is projecting. And if you have a safe mother, and she feels safe, and she's not worried about where her next meal's coming from, and she's got stable housing, she's got extended family, she's got all of these wonderful community supports, she will create for the child an environment of safety that will allow that child's brain to develop in a healthier way. This is why early childhood, the compartmentalization we do with this, is we've got to figure out how to deal with this, because in some way, you know, fundamentals about housing, about welfare, about access to all kinds of services, those things influence the early childhood environment. And in many ways, the you could frame this issue of early childhood as the root of your criminal justice policy, as the root of your health policy, as the root of your mental health policy. And some places have started to think in that way, but this remarkable pervasive malleability of the brain early on, including that relational capability, is something that it's a gift. I mean, it's a great gift to our species, and unfortunately, we are not being all that wise about the way we take advantage of that gift. It's a time in life when the brain is easiest to change. Yet it's a time in life when we spend the least amount of public dollars to try and influence brain development. And, we spend more money trying to change the brain when kids are 17, 18, 19 in the criminal justice system, mental health system, substance abuse treatment systems, and education systems. And the brain can change, but it takes more repetitions. Back when the brain is easy to change, we've got a little funding, a little support, and I'm not sure how to solve the problem, but that's y'all's job.
We do have another question. Representative Mariani?
Thank you, although you might have answered it just now, I'm sitting there like, okay, so he's enticing us, with, to think about some new systems delivery, models here. And I think in my gut, most of us, I think many of us in our gut, feel that we have a good way in which we deliver governments, we make appropriation decisions of the commonwealth to pursue good civilized goals here. But I think many of us also struggle with this sort of nagging notion that we're trying to do that within an outdated delivery system.
Right.
And so we'll have these little conversations. Once in a while, you'll see, sort of the beginnings of bills. So my question was going to be, so what have you seen? What have you seen, broadly out there? Right. Where?
Well, let me give you.
You point us to the right. Set that out further.
Well, and this may, this is actually a step in the right direction, I think. And I've done a lot of work with the province of Alberta in these dilemmas. And one of the things that we've done up there, and they've done, is that they recognize that there are all these silos and this fragmentation. And they also recognize that they end up sometimes making child policy and education that's actually at odds with or redundant to policy in another domain. So the premier, Ralph Klein, when he was the premier, kind of a good old conservative codger, but he was a smart guy and liked children. And he understood that that was incredibly wasteful, and that it was, you're all in the same boat, but you're not pulling the oars at the same time in the same direction. So he, working with him and other people up there, we did a couple of things. The first thing that we did is we said there needs to be the joint development of policy around children. It can't be fragmented early childhood policy and then health policy for kids and maternal child wealth policy. So they started a standing committee where the heads of all of the ministries up there meet once a month on child-related issues, and that's where the policy sort of issues are discussed, and they emerge from that group. And so there's the joint development of policy across all these silos. The second thing that they did that was very smart that I really pushed hard was that they created a child and family research unit that's funded by government, but it's separate from government. But every time they have a child-related law, policy, or change that they want to make, they basically vet it with this research group. And going back to the comment that the gentleman who left made about comment about outcomes, that you know, it really is responsible for government to make sure that the investment of this money is responsible. So before proposing funding a bill or a project or a program that might be some representative's pet project, what they do is they say, all right, here's the issue. You go out there and you find out what are the best practices, what do we know, what do we not know, and before they actually even write the law, they have to go through this process of having this review of what's available, what's the best practice, what makes sense, what have outcomes. And that, I think, is a very interesting, and I don't know whether that's a possibility here, but I think it's a really sensible thing to have a mechanism to be informed by best practice. And because I've seen in other places, you know, and I'm sure this doesn't happen here, but law essentially gets passed because of some headline that pushes some anger, that pushes some sort of well-intended but not well-thought-through law that then gets memorialized, and you have to kind of work around it, and it doesn't have the effect that you wanted and so forth. So, anyway, I'm rambling, but those are a couple of examples of things that I've seen at work.
Those are good points. I mean, we are not very strategic here, especially we're all up for election every other year, so that plays into it, too. And I'm going to call on Representative Mack. I just want to say, also, we have something called the Family Impact Seminars, and that's the university is trying to encourage us, so members, you've heard about that, looking through a lens like that
right.
for policy, but boy, it's hard to discipline ourselves, and yeah. We have thought about that. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to ask, I had the privilege of getting to hear you yesterday in Health Policy Committee, and you had mentioned in there, talked a little bit about how there's no silver bullet as to one entity is the solution.
Right.
Government can't alone be the solution.
Exactly.
And you emphasized that and went off that, and I thought that was, you had some interesting points. I'm wondering if you want to elaborate on that here and how what you've sure. seen work in other areas where, you know, it's been a multi-pronged approach from different entities in society, whether it's business or I know that I would love to hear more about that. What you've seen work when groups come together, what doesn't work, stuff like that.
Right. Well, an issue like early childhood or all of the issues that we deal with that have to do with children and families across the life spectrum, it really, I think, is government is not going to solve these complex problems alone. And government is not designed. There's no research and development branch to government. The way government sort of does that is we send out an RFP, you know, we give some money out there and hope somebody steps up and kind of does this for us. And instead of having an existing infrastructure where that takes place in a much more efficient way, we kind of depend on this ad hoc R&D model, which is kind of inefficient. But in many ways, I think that the best things that I've seen are where there's been an ongoing relationship between the philanthropic community and academia and government. Where, for example, in Alberta, that agency I'm talking about, the Child and Family Research Unit, is basically informed by academia, and it is funded in large part by a joint effort from philanthropic organizations and government. So it literally is something that's done hand in hand. They agree beforehand on both sides, we're going to give this long-term sustainable funding so that it's predictable, and there's an opportunity to really create this environment where people can think. You know, the way we take our legislators and compress you into a certain period of time and have, like, what, 180 days in a row where you have scheduled from 6 in the morning till 9 at night and ask you to sort of review 26 bills you're going to review? I mean, it's like, it's crazy. I mean, no offense, but it is not the best way. It's not the best way to get the best thinking out of all y'all. And it's what we have, but the reality is you need help. Government needs help, and government, it can't solve these problems. The corporate sector should pony up, the public sector, the philanthropic sector, and academia, and when they all work together, that's where I've seen the best things happen. A great model for this actually is what has happened in Arizona. The United Way sponsored some academics to come in and talk about the importance of early childhood. Corporate folks on the board of the United Way heard this, said, hey, this is important. They stepped up and said, we're going to put some corporate money into early childhood issues and education, and this is important. And they said, hey, we know the political, you know, the people in politics, we're going to make them pay attention to this. And essentially it was a process where the corporate sector became informed through the academic sector, sponsored by the philanthropic sector, that went to government and said, Napolitano, I want to hear you, you know, are you child friendly? You tell us what you're going to do for kids, and we'll tell you how much money we're going to give you in your election campaign. And they helped her get elected. And now they have a child cabinet, and they have child policy, and they're conservative, and they're poor, and they're creating really some innovative things in early childhood in Arizona. So,
interesting. Well, thank you very much. We very much appreciate you being here, and hopefully we somehow, if we can keep in touch maybe through, I almost said Senator Cascaden, through Sheila, who is helpful in bringing you here tonight, and we'll be following your work. I suppose you have a website or something?
Yeah.
Well, you want to mention what that is? Give a good little plug.
It's childtrauma.org.
Okay.
Childtrauma.org. And it, you know, it's a sleepy little, you know, it's not a fancy website, you know. We don't have any fade-in and fade-out stuff or, you know, animation things. It's just a bunch of papers, and some of them are useful and, you know, some of them are kind of scientific, but we try to write some things for the lay public, so.
Well, thank you. You're very humble. We appreciate you being here today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity.
Members, we can either do the February forecast. Do you want to do it real quick, or would you rather wait? How much time will it take? A couple of minutes. Members, should we go ahead and you want to go through it real quick? And yeah. So Ms. Adrians will talk about the February forecast.
There'll be no information in here about brain synapses or anything really cool like that. It's just numbers. But if you look at the spreadsheet, I just want to quickly talk about how this is different than the last spreadsheet that you were given. What I've done is updated it for the February forecast. So all of the governor's recommendations are the same. You'll receive another update of this once he releases his supplemental budget. Until then, this is what we have to work with. And of course, there's no accounting for the federal stimulus money on here either. This is all just general fund dollars that are in here. The only programs that changed with the forecast were ECFE, health and developmental screening, community ed, ABE, and MFIP childcare. And with the exception of MFIP childcare, the other changes were all for the biennium total for 2012 or 2011. They were all under like 300,000, so they were pretty minimal. And the majority of changes have to do with changes in participation levels. So it's kind of the programs just figuring out exactly how many people they need to fund. I'll have you look at the MFIP Child Care Assistant Grants. That's on line 35. And so the total for the February forecast for the biennium is now $143.7 million. And that's an increase of about $14 million. And then in the tail, the increase is about $9.6 million. So that's typically that can swing either way, and again, based on participation. So there's just been an influx in need for MFIP child care. And the other change that I wanted to point out that I did on here is for the child care portion on the bottom, everything from lines 34 down. I didn't previously have the governor's recommendations broken out, kind of like I did for the education piece. So I've just broken that out to explain what each of the changes were for MFIP child care and basic sliding scene child care development. So, but again, the numbers didn't change from the governor's recommendations before. So if anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Ms. Adrians, I don't know if you can answer this, but is the governor going to be coming out with a supplemental budget?
Oh, I have no idea. When?
Yeah, or when. He will be right, too.
Yes, there will be a supplemental budget, and like I said, I'll update the spreadsheet with those changes when that happens. But, yeah, I am not clear on when that will happen.
Okay, thank you. Well, thank you for the update.
No problem.
Members, also just in your packet from CISA, who's up in the audience, Keller, we have statistics on the allowances program at New Horizons, so you may want to take a look at that. Next week, on Tuesday, I don't know if we'll have representatives still, but Tuesday, hopefully, and then we will have some testimony on department bills next week. So thank you. Have a good weekend. With that, this is adjourned.